I don't know about Delta, yeah. I mean, I have to fess up here. I don't have a master's in any of this stuff either. I've got a doctorate in literature. It's going back as well. And so not long after you'd got your early pre-Delta thing.
Yeah.
That's what I was doing. But I've been tutoring on diplomas for a few years. And it's really, I've learned a lot from Jeff, but it's really been a lot of my stuff has been self-taught and like following up. So I mean, yeah. Jeff's the real authority on a lot of this SLA stuff, and I've learned a lot from him. But I have to fess up that I don't have either.
That's interesting as well.
But I have to say that on the diploma stuff that I've taught, there's very little depth gone into. And it seems to be a little bit like, okay, let's look at some of the main questions in SLA, but it doesn't really impact very much on teaching practice, which is one reason why I've kind of left that behind a bit.
No, I mean, just over the years, I keep hearing, not necessarily in terms of ELT, but in sort of, primary, secondary teaching, I hear... questions and debates over is teaching an art or a science, and the people who are sort of coming down on the side of art are kind of probably not paying too much attention to SLA, I suppose, in ELT, I'm quite interested in that, especially in terms of giving feedback to teachers and just all the CPD we're doing in the school. I myself haven't really paid too much attention to SLA, but it's just obviously the root of everything, really, isn't it?
It is, but at the same time, it's I think we can only take it so far. It's not really about teaching it doesn't really tell us how we should teach. I think that's a point that Mike Long made in one of the things he did for us, that it tries to explain how we acquire a language, but it doesn't necessarily then take that step to say what the best way to teach it is. And I suppose that's what he's trying to do with this with PBLT stuff. And I think he goes a lot further than most of them do, because when you look at it, and I don't know if you had a chance to look at that Ortega chapter.
Yeah, no, I was actually just, I got a couple of tasks in, but I am a little bit behind, and I've got a couple of things coming up over the weekend, so I'm going to fall behind again. But I was just reading it this morning.
Right.
We can come back to it. One question I had isn't there anything more recent, though? Because it sounds like these developmental sequences sound like, really interesting and really significant, because it is kind of 20 years old, that chapter. It talks a lot about Spanish and Chinese. And I just wondered, are you aware of anything that is, much more sort of focused on English and also more recent,
I think that the chapter's 10 years old, right? I think it's 2009, I believe. But yes, no, that's a good question. That's something I'll have to ask Jeff, and we'll see what he says about that. But as far as I know, there's a lot of ongoing work on this. But I think you raise a good point, because I mean, we'll go over this a little bit, I think, this chapter, because I think it's interesting. But she makes the point that we shouldn't use this work, or we can't use this work, or it's unadvisable to use this work to develop curricula. And we don't know enough about it yet. And secondly, there's the point about whether, should we be building a curriculum around structures anyway? Because, I've seen people make the point, and I think sometimes when Jeff argues against structural syllabus, he sometimes gets pushback from people saying, well, you talk about developmental sequences, surely then we should just build a different type of structural syllabus. that's based more on what we know about acquisition. Mm-hmm. And that isn't really the point. It's ignoring so much to base the syllabus around acquiring structures is ignoring a lot else about second language acquisition. One of the things is not linear. It's focusing purely on structures, we're ignoring lots of things, maybe like phonology, lexis, pragmatics. And so, you know, we do come back to the fact that knowing about these sequences doesn't necessarily give us a new type of, or it shouldn't lead to thinking about language again in terms of a sequence of structures. But what it can do is inform us a little bit about how we correct, what language we maybe focus on with different learners at different points. And it's no more than a guide at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, no, a really good point, yeah. I was thinking of using it more in terms of, you know, actually the task and thinking about corrective feedback. Mm. And, understanding someone's interlanguage and, you know, where they are on this route to the target language, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it'd just be very helpful for me, for teachers to have, more of an awareness of potential developmental sequences, just because it links into interlanguage development. Mm-hmm. And, why people are making, or why they could potentially be making mistakes. So, mm-hmm. you know, it would sort of enrich the choices you're making as a teacher about your interventions.
Exactly. And also I think it opens our ears hugely to what our learners are producing. And maybe when we first start teaching, we sometimes recoil when we hear certain errors and we go, you should know better than that, you know. And I think what with this kind of research in mind, it opens our ears to hearing that as signs of development of where they're at. And and also I don't know, do you have much experience learning other languages, Gary?
Well, I've had a go at two with Spanish actually, and with Danish. Mm-hmm. And so that they're quite different and presented different problems.
Right. I've obviously living here, I've been learning Spanish for quite a while. I was in Central America as well for a while, and in the last few years I've been trying to learn Catalan. So I'm kind of now more aware of my own interlanguage and how it works. But I'm reading that Ortega chapter, I was even like, my God, that's so true. And she mentioned how instruction can sometimes influence certain processes. So this process, she talks about overgeneralization, that we get a rule or we get a representation of a rule, but we apply it, over-apply it. No, the typical one, no, we, and kids do it as well, don't they? They put ED on the end of irregular verbs. No, but it's interesting, no, because as well, my daughter, she's speaking a big mix of Catalan, Spanish, and a bit of English. Uh-huh. But she's even demonstrating this. I've just become so attuned to what she's doing. You know a bit of Spanish, so you know that I don't know in Spanish is no sé.
Yeah.
Irregular. And she was producing that perfectly well. And then she started saying no sabo. So she's taking saber and she's like regularizing.
Yeah.
And now I think she's back to no sé. I'm not quite sure where she's at, but it's fascinating. But then as an adult learner of Spanish, then one thing that I got off this Ortega, she talked about instruction can often emphasize, or it can, like, I suppose it leads to more overgeneralization. Mm-hmm. She mentioned the Spanish subjunctive, which is horrible. So I just started flooding my everything with a subjunctive. I started putting it. I was so pleased with myself that I'd kind of learned the structure that I guess, but I didn't even realize that I was just over applying it to many contexts. That's the case that she mentions, and I was like, no, you're absolutely right. And that was I was working with a teacher at that point who insisted that I would not use the subjunctive enough. And then she was like, whoa, wait a minute, what are you doing? You're using it for everything, practically. Yeah. So I don't know where I'm at now, but maybe something somewhere slightly more balanced than I was. But
Yeah, I remember trying to apply as a jumper as well.
Yeah.
When I was learning my Spanish.
Yeah, well, it's a horrible
thing.
It's something that we don't really have in English. So I suppose that influences on how difficult we seem to find it.
But then when I actually do remember when I was learning it, I then remember trying to think about it in English. And I'm sure there was a period when I actually used it, slightly more, because we don't really use it in English. But if I think if you're from like the West country or something, you might, like if you're some sort of country yokel, sort of, you might say, I'd be a farmer or something like that. Or, I think I was trying to apply it at some point in English as well, or find uses for it or things like that.
Yeah, well, I think there are places that we seem to use it, but it almost sounds overly formal. No,
yeah.
The whole thing. I recommend that you, or that he pay attention. You know, we only notice it if it's in the third person.
Okay.
Otherwise it seems to slip our attention completely. So, I guess that makes it very difficult to pick up as well for learners. Isn't it?
It does sound very awkward. Yeah.
Non-salient. The example I always use is the God Save the Queen. I never know how relevant that is. If someone asks me about subjunctive in English.
Oh, yeah?
Well, it's not God saves the Queen, is it? It's God save the Queen. It's would that God save the Queen, more basically.
Oh, right, okay.
It's an injunction to God to save the Queen. And that seems to shut people up for long enough that I can change the topic.
Okay.
Get them onto something else. Anyway, looking at some of, I know it's a little bit sketchy, the information in the article, but did you notice anything in some of the tables that, I know they're not all about English, but anything that you've noticed in your own learners that that you can see applies to them?
There's the German table. I was just looking at the German table.
Uh-huh.
What other table? Is there another table? There were a couple of smaller ones, weren't there?
Okay. Yeah, let's see. The English ones are, the first one are the morpheme sequences that I mentioned briefly in my presentation, which
what's that? 6.1.
So that they get... No, this is talking about accuracy. So I think it's like they're considered to be at one of these stages when they get about 80% accuracy with these structures. And so ing on the present participle is something that comes in the first stage.
Yeah, I think it might do, what would I say about ing? I'd perhaps say that depends on the learner's L1 actually to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think, is it, as I think about this, I'm thinking, certainly Indian speakers.
Mm-hmm.
So that must be Hindi speakers would just overgeneralize that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe Turkish and Arabic, I'm not sure. Maybe, certainly Turkish, perhaps. I haven't really looked into it.
What kind of? I guess you get a big wide range of L1s, a big wide range of nationalities.
Yeah.
What are the predominant? What are the main kind of main L1 speakers that you get?
We do have a really broad range of nationalities, but there'd be six big ones. So it'd be Japanese, South mm-hmm. Korean, and Taiwanese, and then Brazilian, Mexican, and Turkish would be number six, and mm-hmm. then we'd be into the Middle East.
Oh, Mexican's one of the big groups. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the idea here is that they'll get the ing form, but they'll not be very confident at manipulating the B auxiliary. So if students are using, well, as you say as well, they'll overgeneralize the ing form a lot. But they might not get the B auxiliary until the next stage. And that's something certainly that I've noticed with quite a lot of people. And then the other one is that they'll master the irregular past before they get the ED. Although, as we know with ED as well, that gets overgeneralized to irregular forms that they don't that they haven't picked up properly yet. And certainly, yeah. Third person S and possessive S come really late as well.
Yeah. Okay. With ing, I've always sort of, not always, but for a long time, thought about what have I been thinking about. Yeah, just the continuous form. Just how little we actually use it in everyday, sort of routines and conversations. And I haven't got the reference, but I remember reading somewhere that it was like for every instance of using that continuous form, we're using the simple form 25 times or something.
Oh wow! Yeah.
Although I've just used a continuous form, we are using.
I wonder if we've started using it more since we've all got mobile phones and we're all answering this question. What are you doing? I'm standing in this, you know, that Dom Jolly thing with the enormous phone where he's saying, I'm standing in a supermarket. Yeah. Because the context in course books are always stupid things like describing what someone's wearing.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, how often do we actually do that? It seems to be something that gets picked up quite quickly, like you say, gets overgeneralized, but then maybe later gets initiated. But then that third person takes quite a lot longer. What I was a bit confused about in that table was the articles at and the coming in the relatively early, the second stage in that morpheme accuracy order. But I can think of, I mean, maybe I wonder if L1 has a bigger influence here because I'm thinking of people with Slavic languages.
Yeah.
And that must influence, surely, how early that comes because I can think of quite a few.
Yeah. Still an issue all the way through to C1 with.
Yeah, it must be. There must be certain elements of L1 that influence more than others, even though obtaining it emphasizes that this is regardless of L1 background. Anyway, that's something that again you can please guess about.
So that's one sequence. Let's see. We'll skip 6.2 because that's Spanish more than anything else. Although I mean, because you learned a bit of Spanish, it might be relevant to you. I certainly, it chimed with me that she talked about this uncertainty of using the imperfect past, and that we tend to apply the pretérito more, that gets overgeneralized much more than the imperfect, because the imperfect comes later, which certainly chimes with my experience learning Spanish. It took me a long time to figure out where I should be using imperfect past forms. So encontraba instead of encontré.
Yeah, no, me too.
Really tough.
I was interested actually. I think I don't know if it was Mike Long in that session 7 where he mentioned how the present perfect might be kind of not disappearing, but might be occurring less frequently as American English becomes more dominant. And what did you eat this morning? I think, what was the example that you gave? But it's very good actually.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember him saying
I remember that, yeah,
because living in Ireland, it's very mid-Atlantic. Even, you know, it's like her Hiberno English is really mid-Atlantic. And but there's much more and increasing influence from American English, and I hear like Irish people saying that, because they don't actually have perfect tenses in like Gaelic, so a lot of the language is already sort of, you know, there is some degree of translation going on. and they're not really using present perfect as certainly as much as I would.
Can you tell me an example where they wouldn't use it and you would?
Yeah, no, there's loads. They just use after. So what would they use? They would say, I'm after going to the shops.
All right.
So instead of I've just gone to the shops, or I've been to the shops, or you know, but it's really, really common. It's that would be, you know, 50% of the population would be saying that. I'm after going to the shops.
Okay. But that's not something you would get in US English, I don't think.
Okay, no, that one you wouldn't. But it's
they might say I just went to the shops, they might say, possibly.
In the US?
Yeah.
Okay, so but I think it was that example of did you eat breakfast?
Uh-huh. Or have you eaten?
But also Irish people would use that US expression.
Well, in Scotland we're famous for the future perfect and that you'll have had your tea.
The one we're supposed to say when a visitor turns up unannounced and you say, ah, you'll have had your tea, which exempts you from the obligation to provide tea for the person. Anyway, this is something that is an interesting case, and I think Mike Long's been in the States for a long time. So when we mentioned this, I mentioned present perfect as a kind of marked form for Spanish speakers learning English, but I was really referring to peninsular Spanish speakers because it's still used quite heavily, but it's used in a different context than we'd use it in English. Yeah. So a Spanish person would say, I've done something this morning, que he hecho algo esta mañana, when they use it with a time marker, when the time is recent. Mm-hmm. And in English, we don't do that. So that's kind of an area where I think we were talking about should we here explicitly teach a rule? And it's an area where I've found it maybe just briefly highlighting that rule can help. It doesn't have an immediate effect, obviously, but it certainly gives them a reference point to think about how their output is different from mine in that context. But that, as he said, that doesn't apply in the States, possibly. And it's a, you know, Latin American Spanish does follow a similar pattern to North American English in terms of how they use the perfect forms.
Okay.
And I used to make the facetious remark that it's because they're they don't have any history over there, so they don't need to connect present and past. But obviously just being that's me being a twat. Anyway. Anyway, that's some of the Spanish examples there, and then I think we've got something different in table 6.3 is the developmental stages for negation, and interesting here I think is this idea that even people in whose L1 there is, you would put the negative after the verb, they still seem to go through this first stage of putting the negative before the verb and saying things like, no see him or no saw him.
Yeah.
That for me is that's really interesting, I think.
Yeah.
You'd expect that from, say, Spanish or Portuguese speakers, but not necessarily from speakers of languages who don't do that in their first language. So it seems to have something, it's not just to do with this L1 influence, and it seems to apply across different things as well.
How short? Am I short?
Yeah.
So it's a fantastic call, a potential pod party.
Okay, good.
Because sorry, people are not hearing it.
That's all right.
That's okay, good.
That's very good.
Yeah.
Hot Gary.
No, you have to be quiet now.
Dad, and why have my baby? You know that in a way.
Okay. But we're just sorting out the sequencing of the summer activities.
Good, well, that's something's easy to sequence.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was that. And then I think the other one here, if I go down, was it the question formation? Yes, 6.5, I think. It's one of the most rigid orders that Ortega talks about. So
it's, yeah, that was a, is that the German one? No,
this is English as well, 6.5. And it's 6.5. Emergence of questions in L2 English. It's page 91.
Oh my god, okay.
Anyway, it's just interesting here that.
Sorry, I'm missing page 91 in the version that I've got.
Ah, are you? Yeah. Okay, well, maybe I can send you a copy of the table. Let's see if I can take a picture of it just now. 1 second. I don't know if I can do that here. Hold on. No, how do I do that? Chat, can I attach something to chat? Compartir. I'll just share my screen, maybe that's the idea. Can you see that?
I can't, yeah.
Now share the film, okay? I'll have share the film on the iPad and then do it.
Okay, good lad.
Okay, so this is like the, I think this is borne out by a lot of our observation in the classroom, this idea of simply raising the intonation to form a question, starting with fragments and then progressing on to sentences with rising intonation at the end, right? It's actually interesting to consider how often native speakers form questions like that. And you hear it a lot, right? And you don't hear the auxiliary very often. Maybe it's there implicitly. I think it's funny when people consider that to be just an incorrect way to form a question when so many native speakers seem to do it like that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the sequence is kind of fairly predictable, but putting the question word in, but not the auxiliary necessarily, and then gradually getting the inversion mastered. So in sequence 4, being able to form things like where is something, where is the sun, etc., and then that expanding out. And the last stage there, I think, is really the hardest and often not acquired, right? Forming negative questions.
Yeah.
Using question tags. And indirect questions, right? Which I find a lot that people seem to hit a kind of ceiling with that, or hit a block. And when they're saying things like, can you tell me where? It's so ingrained to then invert that they find it difficult to not invert.
Yeah.
And then the next case, let's see if you've got this one. Well, we can look at it on the screen as well, is this one. And the relative clauses. Now here they're in German. But this again, I think, came to me as a bit of a revelation. So the idea is that there is a maximum, in any language, a maximum of 6 types of relative clause. And the 6 types are there, starting with the subject 1, direct object, indirect object, using a preposition, and genitive, and finally a comparative 1. But not all languages have all 6. So Ortega talks about, what did she talk about? Is it Tagalog? Maori and Tagalog only have the subject type of relative clause, the first one in the list. But that if any language has another one further down the list, it necessarily has all the ones that precede it.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, so I have. This is just where I'd got up to this morning, actually. So I haven't really looked at this.
Yeah, it took me a bit of time to get my head around it, to be honest with you. But it was kind of a revelation. So if a language has a clause where you can put a preposition, like the fourth example, no, it was a foreign land in which people spoke a foreign language. If a language has that structure, it will also have the three preceding ones.
Yeah.
So this again, I suppose, is support for universal grammar, right? Support for this kind of underlying set of possibilities in all languages that are activated in some languages but not in others. But the other funny thing about this is that later on, Ortega comments that it's one of these things where some sequences are easier, are more responsive to instruction than others. And this is possibly a sequence that's more responsive to instruction than others. So, for example, with the question formation one, learners, they just can't get the next sequence until they've been taught the first, or until they've acquired the previous one.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, you can jump ahead, but something weird happens. So she cites a case where learners had acquired the first type of clause, so they were able to produce subject clauses like the first one, and then without teaching the two next ones, the teacher jumped to teach the object preposition, and the learners were able to do it, but they got the other two in between for free, if you like, without explicit instruction. So somehow, like, you're able to jump some stages, but learners will pick up the intervening stages as a kind of necessary prerequisite, even if you don't explicitly teach them. So I guess they've noticed it in the input, and because you've jumped ahead, they're able to kind of like acquire them, as she puts it, for free.
Okay.
So it's just the point that she makes there is simply that some sequences are more responsive to instruction than others.
Yeah. No, again, that would be really useful. You know, if there are these sequences where you can jump ahead and free ride, so to speak, on perhaps earlier stages in the sequence, that would be really useful. It would have a big or a substantial impact on instruction and correction and things like that in the classroom.
It would. It would mean that maybe you're thinking, maybe I'm not wasting my time by jumping ahead a little bit here, but it's still that they're not going to be able to skip any stages, but they might acquire those earlier stages kind of along the way, if you like. Whereas that doesn't seem to work so easily with some of the other sequences that she mentions.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's just an important conclusion. But also that a lot of languages don't have those last ones, especially the object of comparison. The job went to the driver who Peter is more qualified than. It was just a horrible sentence, but anyway. But if they've got that one, then they've got the rest of them. And I think English is one of the few, and you can see the German doesn't have that. Mm-hmm. In the German side, it's not applicable. But English is one of the few that has all six. Anyway, that's I think these are the most significant ones. Shall we just have a quick chat about her conclusions? I know you've not read it all yet.
Yeah, but... I at the beginning I read there were five conclusions, but I haven't got there yet.
Well, we'll just mention them, and you'll get your head around them more. Let's see. The first conclusion, I think, won't be a revelation to you. It's this idea that we hear a lot, that instruction cannot affect the root of interlanguage development.
Mm-hmm.
With the caveat that I just mentioned, that sometimes you can jump ahead, but the learners are going to have to acquire the other ones previous to it. So, for example, she mentions the case of past perfect, and studies show that learners won't acquire the past perfect until they've got ED with 80% accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
So they need, first of all, to have acquired ED with to a quite a high degree of accuracy. And secondly, of course, they need to be speaking in context that require the past perfect to emerge. That's to say, you know, they're having to sequence a narrative. So, I mean, that's something I think that definitely influences perhaps how we teach narrative narrative tasks and what we expect from students in terms of narration. And it's something that's certainly borne out by my personal observation that past perfect comes late. Even when, as in Spanish, students have got it in their first language. But I never understood why they weren't able just to transfer it across. But it started to make a lot of sense to me. The other point here is just the use of the word emerge, that when we talk about learners being at a stage, it's because that structure has started to emerge, but it won't be about it being 100% accurate. It's just that with some of these sequences, like the morpheme ones, they can't get to the next one until they've reached a certain threshold of accuracy.
Okay.
So that was that basically. But anyway, it was interesting as well that she mentioned this whole thing about how learners gradually acquire the ability to express temporal relationships or time relationships. That first it'll be just using word order. So you might say things like, come to Spain, learn Spanish, which just signals that first I came to Spain and then I learned Spanish, right? Then they might start using time phrases, and only after that will they actually start using grammar or inflection to signal that. So anyway, this is something to be really aware of during narration. The second conclusion is that talking about these processes, so she mentions five processes: simplification, which we can hear in a kind of like pidgin English, for example, overgeneralization that we've talked about, restructuring and U-shaped behavior, which we've also briefly mentioned, this kind of idea that when I mentioned my daughter who could produce yo sé, and then she went back to yo sabo, which she'd never said before. But this kind of looping back to something that's not correct, but then I guess through noticing what's in the input or whatever, they restructure the internal language to overcome that regression. So U-shaped behavior is this idea that we don't progress linearly, that sometimes we loop back to something that's incorrect in relation to the target language, but then learners kind of can restructure and progress forward again. And then the final process is fossilization, which I'm sure you're aware of. But there are some objections to that. I won't go into it, but Long says that perhaps fossilization isn't the right term, that we need to study learners for a longer period, for example, to see whether they truly have fossilized. You know, is it such a difficult thing to unstick, if you like? So maybe it's the wrong term. Anyway, instructing learners can foster some of these processes and inhibit others. So for example, it can inhibit simplification, but it can exaggerate, if you like, overgeneralization, which, as we mentioned before, this idea of you're taught the subjunctive and then you start to flood your output with subjunctive. But this could be a positive sign. You know, it means that you're kind of, you're testing a hypothesis and bit, you know, this is where focus and form comes into it, really, because if you've got a teacher who's attentive to that kind of overgeneralization, who's gonna recast stuff back at you, then you've got a good chance of hopefully picking it up and restructuring and starting to progress forward again.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the second conclusion. So instruction can enhance some of these processes and it can inhibit other ones.
Mm-hmm.
Third one is something that we mentioned in the presentation as well, is just that premature instruction can be counterproductive. And there are a few studies that just show that it's kind of pointless teaching things before their time. And that learners who are not at that stage or the prior stage will not acquire the structure. And this is the question of efficiency. And I don't know how much you've observed this, Gary, but I've just observed so much inefficient teaching of grammar and trying to get students to use the second conditional and other things that they, and third, and well, I've mentioned past perfect before as well. And it's just seems to me a horrible waste of classroom time.
Yeah.
Except, of course, if you're just teaching this declarative knowledge, that they need to pass a test on declarative knowledge, yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
That's the caveat, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, that issue of efficiency is of teaching is something that I hadn't, to be honest, hadn't really thought about too much before the course. You know, just limited time. You think about learning, but you don't. I don't know. I'd never really sort of consciously thought about efficiency of teaching. So yeah, again, having sort of some information on possible developmental sequences again would be so useful.
Exactly. The two things I took away from switching to this kind of teaching, one was how much time I spent explaining rules in classroom.
Yeah.
And I think secondly, how much time I got my students bogged down in looking at authentic texts or authentic listenings.
Yeah.
And in both cases, I've changed my approach quite radically. But anyway, the fourth conclusion is one we've mentioned already, is this, that not all these sequences present equal challenges. So some are more open to instruction than others. The cumulative ones like question formation are more difficult. It's more difficult to advance students, I think, from one to the next, and we certainly can never skip ahead. But the relative clauses one, as we've mentioned, you could start at a further on stage, and with relevant exposure to input, the students will pick up other ones in between for free.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really interesting, yep. As well.
Yeah, yeah.
So if learners can do the subject one, then maybe we can jump ahead to the prepositional one, in which or by which, and they should be able to pick up the intervening ones. And fifth conclusion, again, we've heard this before, that instruction, therefore, it cannot change the route necessarily, but it can affect positively the rate of acquisition, and it can certainly affect the level of ultimate attainment. That students who are purely in an immersion environment, they get stuck in an earlier stage, and there's certain things they just don't notice, they don't pick up, and they don't acquire. And okay. That's where we save our jobs as teachers.
That's the rationale, yeah.
There's something that we do that seems to work. So, yeah. But I think, as we said, we can be much more efficient about how we do it, how we instruct, when we instruct. The timing is really really crucial, when we intervene, and perhaps how we do it as well. But Ortega's kind of main conclusion is that it's just, we know this much about it so far, and I will try to follow up with Jeff what your question about how much more has been done in recent years. What's the latest on this? It'd be good to know. But it's still unwise, I think, to develop curricula around these, if for nothing else than we don't necessarily believe that a structural syllabus is the way to go anyway.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
And so, yeah, this argument that, oh, yeah, okay, you talk about developmental sequences, well, that's just a different kind of structural syllabus. Let's just get the course book writers to develop their curricula around that instead. Well, number one, we don't know enough about it, and secondly, it's still inefficient, and we're ignoring a lot of other aspects of language learning by having this focus on piece by piece grammar, I suppose.
Yeah, Yeah, no, it's just another tool to have in your sort of toolbox, really, as a teacher, just to be aware of these things.
It is
the research that's out there.
And it's a shame that it's not, you know, it's at least in my experience, I don't know about the Delta, but certainly the Trinity dipped TESOL, I think they could be doing a lot more with that kind of thing. If they're mentioning things like focus and form, I think we have to say, well, look, okay, what do we know about these sequences? What can teachers take away with them? And as we said before, I think it just opens our ears to our learners and it helps us understand why they produce what they're producing.
Mm.
And I think it, I don't know, in my case, certainly, it helps me understand what I'm producing.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of this stuff I come out with as well when I'm speaking Spanish or Catalan.
Yeah.
And your Danish, was Danish, why did you learn Danish? You mentioned
that's how I actually got into teaching, because I was actually a farmer in my very early days, and I was working out in Denmark, and I had this wonderful teacher,
mm-hmm.
Danish teacher, and I just thought, I want to do that. I was one of these people who had 5 years of French, and structural synthetic syllabus, everything that you could possibly do wrong in terms of language learning. That was my experience of it at school. But yeah. She was just absolutely amazing.
Okay. So
I went back. That's when I went back to England, did the CELTA, and then went back to Denmark again for a couple of years. But it's quite difficult to learn Danish because as soon as you get to kind of elementary and you can actually say something, everyone just says in the most perfect London accent, "Oh, that's really good." And they absolutely want to speak English to you.
Right. Yeah.
And pronunciation is, you know, I really understand how Spanish speakers, because then I went to Spain and really appreciated how, because there's only a limited number of vowel sounds in Spanish, why they then have difficulty in English, because in Danish, there's, I don't know if it's exactly double the number of vowel sounds in Danish compared with English, but it's something like that.
Really?
It's absolutely amazing. And even though I did get it, I only actually got it through the teacher just telling me what my tongue and lips and teeth and everything had, the mechanics of it, because I could say it correctly, but I still couldn't hear the difference between various sounds myself. But I was just conscious of moving my tongue in a slightly different way. But for them, that was enough. It's a very difficult language to learn for various reasons. But,
right. And that's another reason why, you know, we can't just limit our teaching to these types of sequences. There's so much more going on.
Yeah.
And phonology doesn't seem to come into a lot of these studies at all.
Yeah.
I'm thinking with the ED stuff is a good example of that. Students might be able to produce ED, but they're pronouncing it wrong. They're putting id on everything, and there's work id and the whole other range of stuff we need to be doing with that to help them.
Yeah.
And it's just to put limits on how useful this is, but
yeah,
I think it's more useful looking at it than ignoring it, which seems to be the case for most teacher development.
Yeah.
Right, Gary, I'll let you go. Thanks.
Yeah. If nothing else, thank you. That was great. That was really, really, another great experience for me. In a nice way to spend an hour for me anyway. So again, thanks for that.
Well, thanks for your positivity. It's certainly a boost to us, because we're flagging as well here. we're flagging. We're looking forward to getting to the end of this and learning as much as we can about how we do the next one, because it's certainly a feature of online courses. There's always a drop off rate. And if we can learn how we can minimise that for future courses, then that would be great. But we've certainly learned a lot about how much we can expect people to do, and you know, it's we've underestimated a lot as well with the challenge.
Yeah.
But it's great to have someone like you who's responding to that challenge. So
good.
So well.
Yeah.
So thanks very much.
Yeah. Could I just ask one other question?
Sure.
I was going to send you an email at the end of the course, but just if you've got a minute here, how did you go about learning or getting a training on Moodle? Is it all self-taught, or is it, I just want to know if there's a training course that you'd recommend to be an administrator.
No, this platform isn't on Moodle. It's not a Moodle platform.
Isn't it?
It's something called Sensei, which is for WordPress. But I've got experience with Moodle because the diploma that I taught on was taught through Moodle. At least the input sessions were. So I worked in further education in Scotland, and we use both Moodle and Blackboard.
Okay.
But I've never been okay. I had a couple of sessions in FE where someone showed you how to put together modules.
Yeah.
So sorry, I couldn't.
Okay, no worries.
Specific
what
thing.
Is it called? Sensei.
Sensei. But we're thinking of changing the platform to one that's called Learn Dash. And there's a couple of reasons. It's a bit technical, but when you're running courses, if you're trying to get funding for certain courses, especially online ones, you need to be able to report really accurately the participation. So let's say in Spain, for example, like a company could, or a school in our case, could put some of their teachers in our TBLT course. But to get the state funding for that, they would have to show how many hours they'd spent on the platform, what were the outcomes of each activity. And Sensei is a bit limited with that. And this Learn Dash one does the same job. It's just basically allows you to put together materials and sequence them. But it reports much better what people are up to. So these are seem to be the two main ones if you're using WordPress platform, but they both cost money and Moodle doesn't. Moodle's essentially free, I think.
Yeah.
But it's a bit clunkier.
Yeah.
But you know, it works very well.
Yeah. Okay. That's good to clear that up for me. Thanks.
All right. No worries. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll be in touch. Much appreciated.
Take care, Gary. Cheers.
Yeah. Bye bye, Neil.
Bye bye. Bye bye.